X-Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Food Industry Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to help keep you up to date.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Food Podcast. I'm Sydney Perlmutter, Senior Food Industry Journalist and Webinar Moderator at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Aish Rashid and Vera Kovacevic. Thank you so much for coming. So I'm going to start us off with a story about cinnamon, and it's not a positive one, a little bit of a spicy one, no pun intended. So specifically, though, about the presence of lead in cinnamon, which has recently emerged as a pretty significant food safety concern. So this is a toxic element, obviously lead, and when it's consumed in large amounts, it can lead to serious health issues, including neurological damage and developmental delays in children. And it's pretty much a staple spice in a lot of kitchens. So this discovery of elevated lead levels in cinnamon products has prompted a bit of a closer look at food safety practices and regulations. So you may be wondering why cinnamon is prone to higher lead levels. So I'll just talk about that a little bit. So cinnamon can be contaminated with lead through various pathways. And one primary source is environmental contamination. So crops that are grown in or near soils with high lead concentrations, often due to past use of leaded gasoline and industrial emissions, can of course absorb lead. Additionally, the processing of cinnamon, including drying, grinding, and packaging, can introduce lead if the equipment or materials is contaminated. Now, water used in irrigation can also be a source of lead, especially in areas with old corroding pipes. Another factor is the use of certain pesticides and fertilizers that may contain lead, which can accumulate in the soil and be taken up by the plants. Not to mention the tradition of adding lead chromate to turmeric, which is a practice in some regions to enhance its bright yellow color, highlights the broader issue of adulteration in spices in general, which can similarly affect cinnamon. So how do we discover lead in cinnamon? And that's through testing and analysis. So food safety authorities and manufacturers use advanced techniques like inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry and to measure lead levels with high precision. This testing is part of the broader food safety protocols aimed at ensuring the products reaching consumers are indeed safe for consumption. Regular testing is critical given the health risks associated with lead exposure. When foods are found to have high lead levels exceeding safety standards, food safety authorities can issue recalls and advisories to protect public health, which I'll get to in a second. And these measures are essential for maintaining trust in the food supply and preventing lead exposure, especially among vulnerable populations like children and pregnant women. So we'll talk about some of the recent recalls. In response to the alarming findings of lead in cinnamon recently, there have been several recalls of cinnamon products in the last few months alone. For example, in March, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, issued an alert for several brands of ground cinnamon found to contain elevated lead levels ranging from 2.03 to 3.4 parts per million. The affected brands include La Fiesta, Markham, MK, Swad, Supreme Tradition, and El Chilar, which are typically sold at discount stores. So this comes after an investigation that began with the recall of cinnamon apple puree and applesauce products in October 2023 due to elevated lead levels linked to the cinnamon in those products. And then more recently, Florida-based Spices USA issued a recall for its Tasty Sawa cinnamon, and the affected cinnamon products have been distributed within the U.S. across Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina, as well as internationally in Trinidad and Tobago and Guyana. Now, these recalls underscore the need for continuous monitoring and improvement of food safety practices. They also highlight the importance of transparency in the food supply chain as consumers increasingly demand to know more about where their food comes from and how it's tested. So the concern over lead in cinnamon is a very stark reminder of the ongoing challenges in ensuring food safety, and it really emphasizes the need for stringent testing, rigorous standards, and transparent practices across the food industry. And as consumers ourselves, it's crucial to stay informed about these issues and support brands that prioritize safety and quality. And meanwhile, the food industry has to continue to innovate and improve its practices to protect public health and maintain consumer trust in their products. So I remember a while ago, we talked about lead in dark chocolate, because I think that was another one of those foods that's very prone to, you know, higher levels of lead. But what do you guys make of this situation? Are you surprised to hear this? Or is it, especially because cinnamon is such a common spice, and are you worried about cinnamon consumption now? I don't want to worry you, but I'm just curious if you are.
Too late.
Yeah, I know. I use it a lot, too.
Yeah, so I actually am not surprised. It just seems like, it's just another product, another food product, another day, that's contaminated with something or another. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's a sad and unfortunate attitude to kind of have, but... really important issues that you brought up in terms of how lead can get into cinnamon. Hopefully, again, we keep talking about regulatory agencies. The onus is on them to really, have more stringent guidelines, more stringent testing, more periodic and routine testing. It just seems like a lot of these recalls happen because not out of routine testing, but just sporadic testing. It doesn't mm-hmm. seem like it's
a good point.
It's a regular thing. And I think that is something that needs to be, implemented more effectively. And the other thing is, do you know whether the FDA or the USDA has specific guidelines for the maximum acceptable levels of lead in food?
So I think you actually had told me that it doesn't, which is kind of surprising.
I was editing your story. Yeah. I didn't think we needed to say that.
But you were the one who told me that it doesn't.
So I was editing your story, and I was like, what are the maximum allowable guidelines? Looked it up, and it said there are none in the U.S. But in Canada, apparently we do. So Health Canada's guidelines are, I think, 0.2 parts per billion, or is it million?
Million.
Million per million.
And if that is, and if it is 0.2, then these lead levels range from 2.03 to 3.4 parts per million.
So there you go.
So that's
10 times higher.
Yeah, very high. And I also, I mentioned this, but I wanted to point it out again, is that a lot of the recalls that I was talking about were from cinnamon products that are sold, at a discount and... at discount stores. But I don't think it should be, you have to pay a premium for leadless cinnamon. You really shouldn't. You should be able to pay for cinnamon at a normal price without the lead in it, right?
It's like, hey, I can't go to Dollarama or whatever because I'm going to get lead-laced cinnamon.
Yeah. Right.
Today, I want to
it's
not
It's not the
have
fault
lead.
Of the consumer for purchasing cinnamon at a discounted cost. We all want to get deals on food, and that shouldn't come at the cost of higher levels of lead. It just doesn't feel fair, you know?
I think you mentioned 5 ways that lead can get into cinnamon
in your
introduction. And I think there was only one way where it could actually be caught and dealt with effectively, and that is if it's due to manufacturing processes like contamination from the machinery. Then they know it's from that. The issue can be resolved. They can clean their machines, etc. The issue's over. But if it's from soil, if it's from the spraying of pesticides, like, what are they going to do? Like, I don't know if there's a way to extract lead out of, like, ground cinnamon. I don't think so. That would be a very difficult process, very expensive. So if it's an issue that's coming from the source, then I imagine a lot of products are contaminated, and I don't know how long these recalls will last, but if it is just from those, let's say, cheaper producers, maybe it was their machinery or something, or the way they packaged it, or some contamination got that way. It seems to me like it sounds like it's like that, and not a broader issue, because I imagine more, producers of cinnamon would be affected.
I think you are right, because I was reading that ground cinnamon is much more prone to lead than cinnamon sticks themselves. So I think a lot of them have to do with how they're manufactured, packaged, shipped, etc. So I think you're right about that. And it would seem, it would be much more systemic issue if it was, like, starting from the soil, that there'd be a really big problem there.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't just affect cinnamon either. It would probably affect a lot of other things.
Yeah, and I know. And this testing for metals with those, like, mass spectrometers, that's not a cheap process.
Right.
Like, those instruments are very yeah. expensive.
Yeah.
You need, like, highly specialized technicians to do that. I don't imagine they should be testing regularly. I guess the only thing they can do is improve their testing frequency mm-hmm. and, like, procedures to make sure it's not there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, would I'm not afraid. I would still continue. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much does the average person eat cinnamon anyways? Like, I don't imagine this is going to affect us
unless you're like
significantly
dunking it on your pot.
Unless you're going to maybe some people are, but I don't imagine this is like a daily staple for many people.
That's a really good point. I just thought of actually is that, you know, lead, it's not like you're being poisoned by the food immediately. It's not like this is a foodborne illness, right? Where you immediately clock, oh, I'm sick from this food. Like, we know that there are consequences to ingesting high levels of lead, but it's not coming, like, immediately. So I feel like for some, it doesn't feel like as serious of an issue because you're not, the problem isn't occurring immediately. These things take years, if not decades, to figure out, you know?
Like lead poisoning, that is acute and, you know, you have to be hospitalized for it.
Yeah.
That you would have to ingest really large amounts.
Right, yeah.
So the amounts that are found, you know, even in the foods, even though they're higher than, you know, acceptable levels, mm-hmm. They're not exactly causing acute harm.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was thinking about is that actually, although the U.S. doesn't have maximum allowable limits, mm-hmm. but as we've heard about in recent years about apple juice being contaminated mm-hmm. with lead and also baby food.
Yeah.
So they've actually, when I was looking it up, they actually did place restrictions and allowable levels on those specific foods.
Ah, yeah. Everything else is prone to lead.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, baby food, that seems criminal not to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this has been a kind of a widespread issue, so it's not mm-hmm. just relegated to spices like cinnamon, but, you know, a lot of other foods as well. So.
And it's not just lead either. I mean, like, when we think about, like, plastic, like PFAS, forever chemicals in food, there's so many things to worry about that aren't those, like, immediate results that, you know, will take years, decades, generations to figure out how toxic.
Long-term effects.
Yeah, and the long-term effects
exposures,
of it. Like, we do have studies, but people don't, I feel like we just don't take it as seriously when we don't get those, like, you know, the consequences immediately. Yeah, so this is just one of those things. But
can be a cause for health anxiety. I mean, you know, you hear people like, okay, we're just going to stop eating. It's like, what do we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like every other day, like I said, there seems to be some kind of a recall, something affecting your food. But at least the issues are coming to the forefront mm-hmm. and we are having these discussions.
Exactly, exactly. Which is funny because our next story is going to focus on why food is really good for you. Okay, so for this next story, I'll talk about Kaiser Permanente, which I'm sure we've all heard of. It's the U.S.'s largest nonprofit integrated healthcare provider. And I'm sure you're thinking, healthcare? This is a food podcast. Well, it's very food-related, I promise. So Kaiser Permanente recently launched its Food as Medicine Center of Excellence. And we've touched on food as medicine as a concept, so I'll get to that in a little bit and just reorient you guys on what that is. But this initiative, though, that they've just started, it seeks to blend the organization's comprehensive care model with evidence-based food and nutrition interventions so they can address nutrition security and diet-related diseases, which are all, as we know, causes of death in the U.S., leading causes of death among adults. And this pioneering center underscores the concept of food as medicine, which is a principle suggesting that proper nutrition can play a crucial role in preventing, managing, and treating chronic diseases. So I'll just touch a little bit more on what food is medicine is. Now, this phrase encompasses a range of evidence-based solutions aimed at combating food and nutrition insecurity, along with chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and hypertension. And these solutions include medically tailored meals, produce prescriptions, culinary medicine, nutrition counseling, and programs designed to help individuals access and afford healthy food. So by integrating these interventions into healthcare, Kaiser Permanente aims to significantly improve the health outcomes of its members and set a new standard in the treatment of diet-driven diseases. So what sets this center apart and why is it unique? Firstly, it's rooted in the comprehensive framework inspired by the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, blending clinical services, research, education, and community engagement. So this allows for a more holistic approach to tackling diet-related health issues. And this center is committed to expanding screenings for food insecurity, developing medical curricula for nutrition training, and creating scalable evidence-based programs for members. And furthermore, it aims to serve as a research hub, fostering widespread adoption of the Food as Medicine programs across the healthcare system. And notably, the center's ambition to shape the future of food as medicine within healthcare is a testament to its innovative approach. Kaiser Permanente's vision is to ensure members that can access, afford, and consume nutritious foods, not just in times of need, but as a continuous lifestyle. Now, the competitive edge for Kaiser lies in its comprehensive approach, combining direct interventions with broad-scale education and research initiatives. So this not only amplifies the impact of its program, but it also promotes a collaborative environment where knowledge and resources are shared to advance the collective goal of improving national health through better nutrition. So as Kaiser Permanente embarks on this journey, the healthcare and nutrition landscape looks set to transform. By leading with innovation and a commitment to evidence-based solution, Kaiser is certainly paving the way for a future where food and medicine are intrinsically linked in the pursuit of optimal health. So, like I said, I know we've talked about the food as medicine concept in general, and I think when we did talk about it, it was a focus on some meal delivery or, programs or food prescription programs. But this is an actual center that focuses on this. And why I think it's a great idea is that, you're not really left to fend for yourself if you don't have the knowledge. Like, they will teach you. It's a comprehensive approach. So I really appreciate that. What do you guys make of it? And based on, all the concerns about food, what do you think of, the food is medicine approach in general?
I'm just wondering, how does one get access to their services, and like, how broad is their reach generally?
That's an excellent question. I couldn't tell you because I know that they just launched it. So I think that remains to be seen. Yeah. But I mean, they did mention, helping people who are like food insecure. I would imagine it's a relatively wide reach if you can access, if you could access it. I know it's a physical center, but I'm not sure if that also, I think there are multiple physical centers as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So people can probably walk in call them.
I think so.
And they have a website, I'm sure.
Yes.
They're launching their service. Yeah. For food as medicine, I agree with that. I think more of that needs to happen across North America. And just, I think the root of it has to start with education, like educating people on healthy, dietary decisions. And then also food as medicine can also help people with certain, especially like metabolic diseases. Mm-hmm. It could help them figure out what they can eat and in what amounts. So I think that's a great kind of new term, new initiative. It hasn't really been used in the past. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is something new, mm-hmm. even though we all know that, healthy food is almost like medicine. But I'm glad that it's being pushed out more to educate people. And I think, it's a great initiative.
And it's kind of tough because medicine is medicine, and no one really is like, oh no, I refuse to eat that if they know it will help them. But food, we all have our preferences, right? It's such a different thing, and food, addiction and is such a real thing and a real problem. But I totally agree with you. I think it's just harder to get into the mindset to realize that food can really be so helpful when it's such like a it can be a really big issue for people to overcome as well, to get over some food addictions or overcome some cravings.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, so you mentioned the Food as Medicine Initiative and how it's mostly like home delivery of like specially
prepared. Yeah, that's
what
we've talked about in the past. Yeah.
Is there anything else really besides that and this?
Not that I know of. I mean, I like was. Yeah, not that I know of. I think aside from those two things, it's more of like a DIY sort of thing, okay. a more lifestyle choice that you choose to do.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm not too sure. I think the meal deliveries are a great idea because you do collaborate with healthcare professionals in tailoring your meals, especially and tailored to whichever, you know, health issues that you have or want to prevent. But yeah, because me personally, I wouldn't really know what to cut out or what to add more of into my mm-hmm. diet to prevent, you know, health issues. And I don't even know if I need to be worried. Mm-hmm. So education is an excellent tool.
Yeah. And I think this is great because it's going for like, I guess people who are more on the poor and mm-hmm. because usually nutritious food costs more mm-hmm. than unhealthy food.
Oh yeah.
And so when you're living in poverty or you have food insecurity, mm-hmm. most of the times you're just buying unhealthy food mm-hmm. to get those those calories in.
Yep.
So I think this is going to really help those
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it will be accessible to those people.
Yeah.
So is there some kind of a business model behind this? Is it a program that is covered by insurance companies or
government? I believe so. I know in the past that Kaiser Permanente has helped a lot of people apply for like federal grocery benefits. I think they're and they've provided more than 116,000 medically tailored meals as part of clinical research studies. So I think they're very well connected. It also says that they joined national leaders in food and nutrition at the historic White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. So they've committed a lot of money to lead sort of this field. So I think, yeah, they're very well connected. And I think the onus hopefully won't be on, you know, the patient and or at least it will be subsidized,
mm-hmm. I hope.
Yeah.
And I can definitely see the benefit you mentioned about people suffering from food disorders, food addictions and things like that. So we know there are so many different disorders that people are suffering from. So I think having a center that can provide that kind of guidance that, mm-hmm. In addition to your healthcare provider, that's all great. But like, I think to have a center and a program solely focused on this aspect, I think it's huge and mm-hmm. I think it's really great.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the same time, I have always been an advocate of, this goes back to Hippocrates from like 400 BC, let food be thy medicine and
yes.
let medicine be thy food,
yeah.
right? So it's not a new concept at mm-hmm. all. However, we have come a long way in better understanding, obviously, human biology and to a certain extent nutrition,
mm-hmm.
but it's not quite all there, you know?
Yeah.
Are blueberries very good for you? How good are they for you? Or, you know, like how many am I supposed to eat? Even scientists don't know that. There's so many gaps still that remain in terms of how food impacts our biology mm-hmm. and how we respond to various foods. And it's very personalized.
Everyone is completely different.
Genetics, yes. environmental factors. Yes. It's such a complex milieu mm-hmm. of things that, you know, are involved in how, you know, we respond to different foods. And obviously, you know, I'm not an advocate for having a McDonald's or, you know, junk food every day. We know that much, that processed foods or
mm-hmm.
foods with a lot of synthetic additives, mm-hmm. depending on what they are generally not good for us.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what is absolutely good for us, we still don't know.
Yeah.
But this is a great starting point. We do have, obviously, an idea of what mm-hmm. things are good and, you know,
mm-hmm.
for us generally. But hopefully this institute also has an R&D or research.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you mentioned that they were doing studies.
Like
yeah.
Clinical trials and clinical studies.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely going to be very beneficial
yes.
as well.
And I also imagine it's not, you know, a one-size-fits-all thing. I imagine it's pretty trial and error. They work with people specifically over, you know, probably a longer period of time to see what works for them. Because, yes, you're totally right. Like, it could take a lifetime, honestly, to figure out the perfect diet for the perfect individual,
yeah.
you know, or for that individual. And then everyone is completely different. And even among people, I think we all have disagreements about what's good for us and what's not. Like, mm-hmm. and Yeah, so it's
and also cultural differences.
Oh, absolutely,
too,
right? You're right.
It's just like, you know, people grow up with certain foods, their comfort foods, the familiarity, and so it's so hard to let go of things. You know, there's an emotional component to food. There's
absolutely
a psychological component.
That's why it's like different from medicine in that regard.
Yeah.
It really is
it's
different.
It's not just popping a pill. There's so much more attached to it. So.
And things you may not want to part with that maybe for your health is better for you to part with, but hopefully moderation is taken into consideration in this, which I'm sure it is. All right. Well, that's the end of this episode of the X Talks Food Podcast. If you like today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the X Talks Food Industry Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.